I've been looking forward for a long time to having Dr. Diane Langbert with us. She's author of a number of books. She's, I think, the world's foremost trauma counselor. She's been at it for more than 45 years. Internationally recognized psychologist, an experienced counselor, co-founded what's called the Global Trauma Recovery Institute at Missio Seminary in Philadelphia, and works with a number of key individuals to deal with sexual abuse, trauma, because it happens, and it happens in a lot of places, in churches, in businesses, in communities, on baseball and softball teams, summer camps, boys' clubs, girls' clubs. It's happening everywhere, and it's happened right here in our own community, as you know. And we wanted to get Dr. Langbert on because one of the things that we've noticed is that an awful lot of people who have experienced trauma seem to know her name. So I began to look into that, and I'm grateful that we have a chance to welcome her to the program today. But Dr. Langbert, thank you for taking time to be with us here on NBL.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
I wanted to pay you a quick compliment. I hope you see it that way. But you have a very dignified and professional way of presenting information. And I've really enjoyed listening to some of the talks you've given. In fact, we aired some of those earlier this week here on WDCX. And so as people have heard you speak, an impression is formed, but at the same time, it's like you're driving a B-52 dropping truth bombs on people. And I don't know if that has anything to do with the fact that your dad was in the Air Force, right? But anyway, that's how I would describe it. Yeah, he was a pilot and very influential. There's a lot you talk about him a lot in the book Suffering and the Heart of God. So maybe let me start there and ask you a little bit about your own background. Because I doubt as a 7-year-old you said, hey, someday I want to be a really experienced trauma counselor. Like, you know, I don't think that's usually in the heart of children. So what was going on in your life that you think in some way may have prepared you for what you do today?
Well, I would say two things. But I would first say that I finished a master's degree and started a doctorate in 1972, and trauma was not a word in the psychological world.
Wow.
PTSD was not a diagnostic category until 1980. So I couldn't have thought up working with trauma because I didn't know there was such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
My father, as you said, was a colonel and a pilot in the Air Force and very influential in my life in many ways. But he had to retire early because of a neurological disorder. And there was a lesson that I learned at one point. I was home from college, and I went into the kitchen to get him something to drink. And he couldn't do anything at that point. He couldn't get up out of the chair. He couldn't go get himself water and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I was getting the water, and I came back to the door, and I saw him trying to get up out of the chair just because that's who he was. And the thought that went through my mind was, a body that does not follow its head is a sick body.
Hmm.
Little did I know that that phrase would resonate in my life as I have worked with so many people who have come out of Christian churches and organizations all over the world who protect their institutions rather than follow their head. And when we do not follow him, we are a sick body. The
yeah.
second stream that fed it was that when I started out, I was working with Vietnam vets, and I was working with many women who asked to see me because I was female, because that was very rare at that time in the field. And they began to tell me things. I think the first time I heard about abuse was a young college girl who threw her long hair over her face so I couldn't see it and said, my father used to do weird things to me. And I had no idea what she was talking about. There was nobody to ask. There were, you know, I was told not to believe them, that they made it up. So obviously, I didn't listen.
Well, let me interject for a second. That is part of what you talk about extensively, is that somebody might say, well, you know, where's her degree from? You say, well, she has a PhD from Temple, I think. I'm not looking at it right now. But, you know,
yes.
So that, you know, you're well-trained as a counselor, per se, a psychologist, but that you actually have chosen, because of the thing you just described and others like it, I'm sure, to be a student of trauma, to be a student of the people that you're working with, and that you have learned a great deal along the way. And maybe comment on that, if you don't mind, because it's not like, I mean, trauma wasn't even a thing when you started, but it certainly existed. It's just that nobody recognized it or knew how to categorize it.
Well, when I actually did go to a supervisor and said, you know, women are telling me these things and I don't know how to help them, and was told not to believe them because women can be hysterical and make things up like that, and if I listened, I would contribute to their pathology. So I quit talking to the supervisor about it, and which probably says something about me, yes. But anyway, I went back to the women that I was seeing at the time and said, I have no idea how to help you, and you came here for help, but you have to be my teacher before I can be yours.
And thank God for that. Yeah.
They were. Wow. They were. They taught me, this is what happened, this is what it felt like then, this is what it's like now, this is what's happened along the way. So we learned together.
You know, we can get into more details about some of this as we go on, but I just want to touch on a couple things. You alluded to some of the systems that exist, and the idea that if abuse exists, our desire is to cover it up. Like, if it's going to expose a weakness in our family, well, we don't want anybody to know that. Or if it's going to make a ministry look bad, we want to keep that quiet. And then the whole process of healing, I'd love to talk to you about that a little bit later, and you're actually referring to that situation. You had to learn first from the people you were working with before you could provide any assistance. And then there's just a number of other things that I'd like to talk to you about related to this issue. But I think one of the things that I felt frustration about in learning about scandals that have occurred, you know, with international evangelists or major pastors, and sometimes pastors of smaller churches or youth pastors or camp directors or boys and girls club workers, you know, that people don't want to believe it. People don't want to say, of course abuse happened, because I believe the person who's come to report it. It's quite the opposite, I think, and maybe you can talk about that. Just as you said, an awful lot of people are disregarded because we know the person they're talking about, and there's no way that person could be guilty.
Yes, we assume we know people, and that is usually based on their position, status, the work that they do, the success of that work, all of those things, and not on their character. When we follow somebody like that, we assume good character, particularly in the Christian world, because people are talking about God and telling us to think about God and all those kinds of things. And so we put it all together. And the fact is, human beings want to be safe. And so we don't want to entertain that kind of information because it makes us feel unsafe. And it scares us that somebody could be doing that and we wouldn't know. And so we deny the truth of it. And the other piece is, again, in Christendom, they're doing God's work. You're going to destroy God's work. You can't do that. You shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. And so we protect the work and the person rather than seek out the truth.
I don't even know where to go with that because what you said is so powerful, but let me bring in another idea that I know you put forward in your book that relates, and it's the idea of that how we treat people who are wounded or weaker than us or smaller than us reveals ultimately who we are. And then the picture for how to do that the right way, of course, is God our Heavenly Father and the person of Jesus who came to demonstrate in the flesh what that looks like. But that the misuse of power actually reveals the problem with us and tells us very little about who God actually is. And we get confused about that, particularly when talking about the church and ministry. So spend a few minutes talking about that, because I know it's something that you discuss at length.
Well, part of what, again, we want to do is protect God's work. And so we find ways to dismiss the things that would make it not okay, make it not safe or whatever. I think what we have lost along the way is the fact that the faith that we say we have is in a God who became vulnerable for us. He went from heaven and glory and all of those things to be a baby, to be a refugee, to be a hated person, to be a killed person. And so he showed us the way. The way to honor the Father is to be vulnerable with people in wise and helpful and godly ways, and to care for them in their vulnerability, which is what he did. I think that the work of being with vulnerable people with trauma and things like that is basically, if it's done well and right, incarnational work. It is a way of following Christ in that I study him and who he was and what he did while he was here on earth and what he taught in order to be like him more and more so that the fruit of my life looks like the fruit of his life.
At a time when I was serving as an assistant pastor, a gentleman walked in our church building one day during the week. It was at the very end of a season where we had prayed and said, Lord, help us to know what comes next. How do we take the church where it's at today to the next level? What's your plan? What's your purpose? What do you want to do in us? What do you want to do in our community? And whatever you show us to do, we'll do it. And this gentleman walks in and he says to me and the senior pastor, maybe a few others that might have been standing around, I represent a group home where people with developmental disabilities live. And on Sundays, we take them to church. The problem is they make noise and at times mess themselves, and the church we've been attending has grown tired and weary of that, and they said it's disrupting, you know, their ministry, and it's hard to get visitors to come when we've got these individuals there, and so they asked us to leave, and we're just wondering, would you let us bring these men to church? And I remember thinking in my head, and I say this, I've told this story on the air before, but I remember thinking, Lord, I thought you were going to bring like doctors and lawyers and professional athletes who could give big checks and we could build a gymnasium and minister to all the kids in the neighborhood, you know, by having a fancy gymnasium or something like that. This, we're not prepared for this. We don't know how to do this kind of ministry. And maybe this is you saying it, but these guys are just going to be a burden if they come to our church. In the end, let me just jump ahead and say, our church grew by leaps and bounds after that. Because all of us began to understand what the heart of God actually looks like, and we were confronted with our own presuppositions about such things. You know, I don't think any of us were super excited about jumping into that ministry, but it transformed each one of us in the process. So, that I don't know, but we learned something about the heart of God that day. And, you know, you commented in one of your videos that, you know, the disciples were like, hey, get the children away from Jesus. He's trying to do ministry right now and stuff.
Yeah.
That the heart of God our Father is very much for the broken and the wounded, and that if we're going to demonstrate that for others, I think he wants to do the kind of work in us, that we would also care for these things, because as you said earlier, a lot of the people want to just dismiss this stuff. Oh, you know, people that raise these issues, they're just part of the Me Too movement. Tell them to get over it, and let's get back to the ministry. But that's not the heart of the God we serve, and I wonder if what your thoughts are about that, because I think you've seen a lot of similar dynamics in your own work.
Well, first of all, the ministry is standing right there in front of us. And second of all, if I turn from that in terms of vulnerable people or people who come and say they've been abused or whatever, I'm turning from who God is. I'm not following my head. Those are the places that he went.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you think about his time at the well with the Samaritan woman. You know, she was the wrong race. She was the wrong gender. And she was considerably immoral. That's not the kind of person we want. And he sat there with her. And there's some irony to the fact that when she went into the village to tell them about Jesus, a whole bunch of men came out.
Yeah, you're right.
Women aren't supposed to be the person who leads that kind of thing. So there is irony in the story as well, but the fact of the matter is that he goes to the very people we turn from, which means we're walking away from him.
I think what I want to say in response is just I'm so grateful you said it that way, is that there's something for all of us to learn in this, and that if we really want to encounter God the Father, we have to be open to what he's doing in the hearts and lives of broken, and I'll just say messy people. Not that they're messy, but we all live in filth and squalor. And I wonder if, just before we go to break, you'd tell the famous story, or at least parts of it, about what happened to you in Ghana when you visited a place called Cape Coast Castle. It's an incredible story. And it's such a metaphor, maybe, or a parable or something that you can refer back to regarding the heart of God. But I think it was an experience that changed your life as well.
Yes, it did. And I've actually been asked to tell the full story when I'm there to speak, so I will do so. So I'll give a abbreviated version here.
Okay.
But I was taken with a very dear friend who is from Ghana to see Cape Coast Castle along the coast of Ghana, which is where the slave ships used to come in. And, you know, they would get people and take them to wherever. Lots of times they brought them to this country. And they would often be at this castle for the people who were running it, prison for the people who were being taken away, sometimes for a year or two. They had to wait for the ship to come. And so we went down into the dungeons where they kept them. And they would sit there chained with each other and have close to nothing to eat, sit in filth. I mean, nobody did anything for them. They were just going to be slaves. And we were standing there, and they turned out all the lights so we could see what it was really like for them. And then our guide said, "Do you know what is above the prison?" And of course, we said, "No." And he pointed up there, and he said, "It is the chapel." Which meant that the people who were running the slave trade on Sundays or whenever would go up above the prison to the chapel to sing hymns and listen to a sermon and probably take up an offering on top of filthy, dying, some already dead, enslaved human beings. I'm a word person. I had no words for that picture. And when we went outside the prison, I was with a very dear friend, Michael Lyles, who is a psychiatrist, and he looked over at my face, and he knew me well, and he said, "Uh-oh." And I said, "What?" He said, "This is going to show up in a talk."
No doubt.
Because it's like a parable. It's this stunning picture of what we are like when we ignore the vulnerable or the dirty or the abused or the weak. We're doing exactly what they did in that chapel, and we are calling ourselves God's people and think we're doing good while we are destroying human beings made in His image.
So powerful. Dr. Diane Langberg is our guest. She is a trauma counselor. She's been involved in working with trauma victims, sexual abuse victims, rape victims, those who've been trafficked, sold into slavery, victims of genocide, just unbelievable. The kinds of things she's seen over the years, we're going to have an opportunity to dig deeper as we continue. But I want to mention that she's coming to Buffalo on Saturday, April 2nd. We've been talking about it. You've heard quite a bit about it already. But if this is for some reason your first time hearing it, Saturday, April 2nd, she will be in town and speaking at a place called Northgate at River Rock. It's a church on Hurdle Avenue in Buffalo. If you want to learn more about it, I'd urge you to go to our WDCX Radio Facebook page and click on the link that we have there. But also, I want to encourage you, if need be, to get your tickets. And by the way, our link will take you to the same site, but get your tickets at eventbrite.com. It's a free event. It's not free. It's provided to you at no cost. Let's just say that. But it's a free event, and you're going to need tickets to be there, and it's going to sell out quick. So let's just say that. So the tickets will run out soon. A number of them are already taken. But go to eventbrite.com, and then when you get to the search bar, just type in Buffalo and trauma, and you'll see the information there about Dr. Diane Langberg's visit. Her colleague, Dr. Phil Monroe, will be coming as well. He's the director of the Trauma Healing Institute, and we'll talk about that when MBL returns. Our guest is Dr. Diane Langberg. She's a best-selling author. She's a trauma counselor. She speaks internationally and has had a variety of experiences in dealing with trauma and abuse. And I think it's high time that we address this kind of issue head-on, that we And that's why we've dedicated this week, ultimately, to talking about these things in preparation for her visit with Dr. Phil Monroe on April 2nd. But let me pause here for a minute and ask you, if you don't mind, to talk about the broader work that you do. I don't think you run a big operation in the sense of, you know, hundreds of employees, not by any means, but a very significant ministry with worldwide impact. And Dr. Phil Monroe heads up the Trauma Healing Institute. He'll be coming with you. So talk briefly about that, because it isn't just about you discussing these things publicly. You guys are actually got boots on the ground training people to deal with these issues in more effective ways.
Well, yes. I mean, the practice here in the Philly area is not that large. There's 16 therapists here, many of whom have gone to other countries to do the same thing I do and Phil does. And actually, Phil is now overseeing the practice here. So I can't keep up. I'm getting old. Anyway. But we have, and several others here have been to, I've been on six continents. So, and it's always to talk to people who have suffered trauma of some kind. So I've talked to groups that work with trafficked women and children. I've been to Rwanda multiple times and talked with genocide survivors. I've been to Cambodia and talked with genocide survivors. I was in Brazil, where sex trafficking and sexual abuse is staggeringly high. And it's, you know, always been to educate people about those issues and what trauma does to people and what it looks like to walk alongside them in a way that is truly caring and lasting and has a little taste of Jesus in it.
You talk about in some of your writings and stuff that one in three girls and one in five boys are sexually abused before the age of 18, and that's, of course, just based on what's reported. There might be numbers even higher than that based on the fact that some people just never talk about what they went through. There was the Catholic Church scandal that rocked our city right here, but also many of the dioceses across the United States. Ireland was also rocked by a similar scandal. Southern Baptists are dealing with the issue of sexual abuse in the church. We see these things in the headlines. And then every once in a while, you know, an international speaker or a pastor of a mega church or a local youth pastor or, you know, somebody involved in ministry is accused of sexual abuse. And it, like we talked about earlier, we don't want to believe it because, well, this is a good ministry. Look at the work they've done. It's heartbreaking to think about that. And then, of course, with the Me Too movement, the church doesn't, evangelicals anyway, don't readily identify with that kind of thing. So it's like, well, if people are raising these things, they just must be part of the Me Too movement. We really don't want to believe that could be going on in churches. But Jesus Christ is not the church. is not Christendom, the institution of Christendom that we are a part of. His heart is pure, and while we hope to be pure, we're not. So there's that dichotomy. But at the same time, you know, our desire is to kind of protect these works because they're profitable and they're meaningful. And some might say they're effective in the area of evangelism and ministry. So clearly, if an issue is raised, we would need to protect that church. But you go to great lengths to talk about the fact that Christ is not Christendom. And I wonder if you could explain some of that for us.
Well, I think one of the places I would stop is if we look at his ministry here on earth, one of the places where he showed the most anger was the temple. He was there twice. He cracked whips and turned tables over because of how they were treating the least of these. He left there. They didn't listen. He wept. He said, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, I would, but you would not, which is what we're saying when we refuse to do this. Mm-hmm. He's saying, I would, but you will not. And then he went back a second time and he did it. He never went back after that because they didn't listen. And it wasn't all that far down the road after he was back in heaven that temple was destroyed. And so God clearly did not protect the institution. because it was rotten. He does not protect that which is rotting from sin. When we protect those things, we are elevating those things, but like the temple or the church or whatever, above him.
So when we say that a ministry must continue, or, you know, its leaders must remain in place because of, look at all the good they've done, when in fact it's been discovered and proven that sin is present and has occurred in the past that has harmed people, we're actually denying, we're not being like God himself. We're sinning against God, if I hear what you're saying.
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
We are.
Do you think, just a quick question, but I've seen a lot of polls, we've talked about some here on NBL. Every once in a while, Barna or somebody else comes out with a poll that says, you know, look at the number of millennials that are leaving the church. There was a book called The Rise of the Nones, N-O-N-E-S, people who claim to have no religious affiliation. And you say, well, but some of these people grew up in churches. Where are they going? And I've wondered, after reading some of your stuff and after having experienced some abuse in my own life, if it's possible that people have grown tremendously disillusioned with the institutional church. Not that God isn't still present there or wanting to work in the lives of people. I think that he is. But when the institution becomes bigger than the work he really wants to do and is resistant to change or telling the truth about the problems that exist there, that people are wounded in that process. And if you were one of the people that was wounded and then later either removed from the church so that you wouldn't talk to other people about that wounding, then you're a harmed and wounded individual. Who would want to return to church if that was the case? I just wonder if you think that any of this stuff that's gone on probably for 200 years and thousands of years, let alone the last 50, that if that's had an impact on why people are reticent to be a part of, quote, the church, which represents more of Christendom in some ways than Christ himself.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the words we used to use for the church was sanctuary, which means a safe place. And people who feel vulnerable because they were wounded someplace else, people who are wounded in our organizations and institutions, all of those things, are so hungry for a safe place. And at this point, church is not something that pops up in the head as one of those you could go to.
Mm-hmm.
And for many people, a safe place means leaving the church. We're breaking the heart of God by not being a sanctuary and by not living in the truth. Jesus said, I am the truth. I am the light. And we cover things up and deny, and there is no refuge, and we wonder why they're leaving.
It's sad, it's sobering, and let me encourage you, if you have an opportunity, to read some of the books that Dr. Diane Langberg has written. I've read Redeeming Power, Understanding Authority and Abuse in the Church. So Redeeming Power is one of those books. Another one that I'm still working on, Suffering and the Heart of God. And I want to say I absolutely love reading these books, but it takes me about 4 hours to get through a single chapter because it's so deep I have to go back and keep reading, going, wait a minute, this is so good. Anyway, get a copy of one of Dr. Diane Langberg's books if you have the opportunity, or visit her website, Diane Langberg, LANGBERG.com, to learn more about the work and maybe some of the resources that are available. We're going to take another quick break, and we'll continue here on NBL. Our guest, Dr. Diane Langberg, she's coming to town on April 2nd with one of her colleagues, Dr. Phil Monroe. They're going to be doing a Trauma and Ministry of the Church conference, talking about how trauma destroys and Christ restores. They're actually doing that at a place called Northgate at River Rock. It's a church on Hurdle Avenue, 60 Hurdle Avenue in Buffalo. You can learn more by going to Eventbrite, Brite.com, and then search Buffalo and Trauma, or just go to our Facebook page, WDCX Radio on Facebook. Click on the link, and it will take you to a place where you can register to come. It's an event that will not cost you to attend, but you're going to need a ticket to get in. And trust me, it's going to sell out because we're well beyond the 50% mark already. All right, we'll be back with more of NBL in just a moment. We continue the conversation with Dr. Diane Langberg. Don't go away. Dr. Diane Langberg, our guest, such a thrill to have her with us. I became aware of her work after doing a series of interviews with women who had been sexually abused and harmed, talking about their own life and, you know, some of what they had struggled with. And the name Diane Langberg kept coming up, so I Googled it. By the way, Dr. Langberg, one day, a woman told me she had just founded a ministry but then was going to change the name. And I said, well, you know, what are you changing it to? And she said, well, it's kind of strange and it's different. It's trendy. She gave me the name. And she said she wrestled with the reality of, like, should I really call it that? Because it's kind of different. And I said, well, how did you resolve that? And she said, well, I prayed to God. And he said, yeah, that's the name. And she goes, are you serious? And God said to her, Google it. I didn't know that. I didn't know that God would encourage us to Google it, but I want to encourage you to Google the name Diane Langberg and find some of the YouTube videos and other things that are available, because even if you can't make it to the conference on April 2nd, you're going to learn a lot more about her ministry. But, you know, one thing I learned from these young women was that they were hungry for healing and had dealt with a great deal of stuff. I mean, one said, you know, I was told that this was no big deal, that it was an incidental kind of thing, and that I should just get over the abuse that happened to me. But she said, I never felt like it was a small thing or insignificant at 3 o'clock in the morning when I was hanging over the toilet purging. And, you know, whether it was eating disorders or problems with fear and anxiety, problems with getting close to people, you know, intimacy, emotional and otherwise, there were real ramifications. And I think some people believe that if you can maybe get a person rescued from human trafficking, then their problem is over. Or if abuse is occurring in a home and you can rescue that child who's been, you know, a victim of incest, well, then everything's going to be fine. And you clearly know that's not true. But can you help walk us down the road of the process? First of all, provide some hope, because there's many people listening. 1 in 3 women, 1 in 5 boys listening right now who know exactly what abuse looks like and wondering, you know, these behaviors I have in my life, the addictions, the fear, the anxiety, the whatever's going on that I've never seemed to be able to shake, is there hope to get past it? So what's the process for healing?
Well, there's all kinds of fancy words and everything else. Certainly the field has changed a great deal since I started out, and it wasn't a word. Trauma mm-hmm. wasn't a word. But when I teach about it, which, you know, this will be happening when I'm in Buffalo as well, but I have had to find a way to make it really clear how to walk with somebody who's been traumatized and help them deal with the truth of their lives and the damage that it's done and move on with hope and strength. And so what I've done is use 3 words that everybody around the world knows. One is, it requires talking. So you have to tell the story, which for most people takes a long time and isn't done from beginning to end or anything else. But so it requires talking. It requires tears. You can't suffer things like abuse and not be full of grief. And but grief often makes us vulnerable, and so that gets swallowed and ignored and put away because it's not safe to grieve. So it's talking, tears, and the third one, which is most annoying to everybody, is time. Mm. I'm not in charge of that.
Right.
And neither are they. And it's different for every person. And it's not like you do the talking, then you do the tears, and then the time goes by. You know, it's you do some talking, then some tears, and then you need a break, and then you do some tears, and then maybe you figure out what the words are for the tears. Or it's not a this, and this thing, which is very important for people who are suffering to know. You know, they want to do it right. Well, there's no right way. You know, and
sure.
But those 3 things are necessary, and we have no control over the last one.
No doubt about it. In Suffering in the Heart of God, I've gotten to about chapter 6 or so, but you spend quite a bit of time talking about the psychology of evil and sin, which, by the way, I think in the field of psychology, sin is probably not a word. today. It might have been in the past, but I think it's been removed. But you speak boldly about it, and I wonder if you could comment, because, you know, deception is a part of this, abuse, selfishness, cover-up, I mean, and all of which can represent sin. But talk about the psychology of evil and sin.
Well, trying to think of a way to do it somewhat briefly. part of it is that when we talk about those things, what we often fail to recognize and understand is that the foundation for evil and sin and all of that is deception. And if you go back to Genesis, of course, that's the beginning of the end. You know, it's the thing that ruined everything. The great deceiver came to a vulnerable human who deceived herself and then deceived someone else. So when you think, for example, of a situation in a home where a wife is being battered, the person, the husband, who's doing the battering is full of deception.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she wouldn't do this, I wouldn't do that. If she would get it right, I wouldn't be having to do this, whatever. There's all kinds of things that we tell ourselves. And then the victim does. It's, you know, I'll be okay when they're clearly not okay. I'll make it better. I'll do the right thing the next time so this doesn't happen, except that the battering is coming from the other person and you can't stop the other person. You know, we think if we do the right thing, then the other person will stop. So there's all kinds of deceptions that go on, and then it gets into systems as well. So when you talk about a system or a church or whatever, you know, this is God's work. Well, actually, no, it's not. But we deceive ourselves. And so we deceive ourselves, which covers the other deceptions that have been brought to the light. And we really have seemed to have forgotten, you know, again, Jesus said, I am truth. I mean, that's the complete opposite of deception. And I am light. And we don't want the light turned on. I had a West Virginia grandmother who loved Christ and taught me a million things. But she lived in a small house up in the mountains, and she had a cellar that had a dirt floor. And I remember as a child, I didn't like going in there because it was dark, and who knew what was there. And she went over and turned on the light switch, and she said, honey, one of the things you have to remember in life is that if you turn the lights on, the rats will run.
I'm sorry.
Yes. So Jesus, well, everybody laughs. I laugh.
Yeah.
But the point is, Jesus is the light, and we don't want the rats to run. We want them to stay hidden so we can have it the way we feel comfortable. So we deceive ourselves.
I don't know how, even know how to word this next question, but I think it applies here. And I don't know that there's any way to rate this, but somebody might say, what's worse, the abuse itself or the cover-up? Because we talked about this earlier, the cover-up is such a big part of this. We don't want the family named harmed. We don't want the ministry harmed. You know, we don't want people to poke in our business because we've got work to do for the kingdom of God, whatever that looks like. But I was a part of a church when I was a kid, and there was this big announcement once on a Sunday morning saying the pastors had an inappropriate relationship with a woman, quote, it was not adultery, and you're not to ask any questions about it because if you do, you're living in sin. It's none of your business, basically. And, I mean, I was a kid, and I just remember thinking, okay, I want to serve God, so I won't ask any questions. It was only years later that I came to realize what had occurred, and it was, you know, the fondling and abuse in that sense of a teenage girl by the senior pastor. And it was horrific to discover that later, but I often wondered, you know, she disappeared from the radar screen. And I think in many ways she was squeezed out. Like if you are here, then you represent a threat because you might say what actually happened. So you need to go. And in the end, it's certainly a double wound. I don't know that it's worse than the first. But we not only does sin occur, but it's sin upon sin, in other words, is what I'm getting at. If we don't handle this thing correctly, if we don't turn the lights on so the rats will scatter.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're doing damage to the victim. We're doing damage to the people in the pews. We're doing damage to the name of God. And we're doing damage to the abuser. because we have left the abuser in their sin with their deception working.
Yeah. It's so multifaceted. We're going to take another quick break and be back in a moment with Dr. Diane Langberg. Just a few quick segments left, and we're going to continue our conversation. In fact, we need to talk a little bit more about what's going to actually happen on April 2nd, and we'll do some of that when NBL returns. Dr. Diane Langberg, you can find more about her online at dianelangberg.com. She's author of Redeeming Power, Understanding Authority and Abuse in the Church, and then Suffering and the Heart of God, How Trauma Destroys and Christ Restores. And that will be some of the content that's covered on April 2nd. We'll be back in just a moment. If you want to learn more about all this, go to WDCX Radio on Facebook. Click on the link that's there for what's happening on April 2nd, or go to eventbrite.com and type in Buffalo and Trauma under the search bar, and it will bring up a place where you can order tickets to attend on Saturday, April 2nd. It's a free event, 8:30 to 4 at River Rock Northgate, a church at 60 Hurdle Avenue in Buffalo. More to come with Dr. Diane Langberg in just a moment. Well, we're down to our final few minutes together, Dr. Diane Langberg, our guest, and what a joy to know that she's going to be coming to Buffalo in April. Diane, I know that I told you a story a little while ago, so you've heard it, but for the sake of the listeners, I tried for 3 months to land an interview with you, only to discover through a bulk email that somebody sent out that you're already coming to Buffalo. And then I was able to contact some of your people who were gracious to say, all right, let's do this interview so that we can help promote what's going to be happening in April. But I'm just, either way, however you got here, I'm grateful that you're here. You said, I'm convinced that we must start training Christian counselors and churches and Christians to work as missionaries of post-traumatic consolation and care, able to deliver the comfort of Christ himself to a very needy world. I know we don't have a lot of time, and I want to talk some about the seminar here, but real quick, you make a point of saying that when we care for the needy, when we minister to the broken, Jesus himself shows up there. And while we think these are things we probably should avoid so we can go and do ministry, the real ministry happens when we stoop to minister to the lowly, the oppressed, the weak, the broken, as Jesus did. And maybe comment for a moment, because this would provide a little inspiration for people who are wondering, how could I help? How could I play a role in this in some way? Well, the Trauma Healing Institute, I think, helps answer that question, and maybe you can comment about it.
Well, I think one of the things that I would say is that in terms of my own life, of my work, which is actually 50 years this year, one of the things that has occurred over the years is a transformation of Diane.
How so?
It's not just about the victims.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because, first of all, I have frequently been at my wit's end because I don't know how to help somebody. I certainly was that way at the beginning all the time. And I had to be taught by them. I had to be with them. I had to listen. I had to enter in. That's what Christ did. It taught me a lot about what it meant to be incarnated as Christ. And then later on, you do this work long enough, you know, there's a few times along the way where you basically tell God you're going to quit because you can't hear one more story. You can't carry one more awful thing. And that has been the place where he has taught me about the fellowship of his sufferings, which he has invited all of us to enter into. And frankly, most of us don't care to do that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And so the work has taught me about him in ways I don't really have words for, which is odd for me. And secondly, I wouldn't trade for anything. I wouldn't trade for anything. I would have missed it all. And that's what's happening. We're missing it. We're missing him. And just one other thing, you know, in Acts, where it talks about the church first being started and whatever, and I think it was in Antioch where it said they were first called Christian. Well, the word literally means Christ one.
Mm-hmm.
That means you look like him. So anything we do individually or collectively that is not like him isn't Christian, no matter however we use the label. He's calling us to be in the flesh who he is in order to make people hungry for him and the refuge that he is.
Wow. I don't even want to bring it up, but one of the places where your life was changed dramatically because of the trauma you saw and witnessed and heard about was on a trip to Rwanda. And I know we don't have time to go into great detail there, but you detail some of that in your book. Can you comment briefly about how Rwanda changed your perspective on things?
Well, like the Cape Coast Castle Ghana story, they're parables. They're obviously real people and real suffering and all kinds of things. But they also teach in and of themselves. The Rwandan genocide was carried out by Christians. And it does something to you to stand in the doorway of a so-called sanctuary, which has not been touched since the genocide occurred, and what's in it is nothing but bones. And so people went to church to be safe during the genocide, and they got slaughtered in the church. I've seen a lot of things, but it was really difficult to wrap my head around that. Because it's such a stunning picture of what we're doing.
Yeah. Wow. For all of the reasons we've talked about, I hope that you can come on Saturday, April 2nd. There's four different topics you're going to cover. I'm not going to ask you to go into any detail about these four things, but maybe a general statement about what people can expect when you and Dr. Phil Monroe, one of your colleagues, address people on Saturday, April 2nd. But you guys are going to be talking about A World in Trauma and the Call of the Church. Another segment called The Dynamics and Effects of Trauma and the Healing Ministry of Christ and His Church. Another one, Trauma Inside the Church and Christian Organizations. And then lastly, and I think it's totally appropriate, Care for the Caregiver. I got to believe you needed some care yourself after visiting Rwanda and after dealing with some of the things that you've had to deal with in one-on-one counseling sessions. And your books are loaded with information about such things, but any comment itself or invitation for folks who are listening to come and participate on April 2nd?
Well, I would encourage them. It's obviously something that is in the international headlines today, and there is a light being shown on the church, and unfortunately it does have some rats in it. And to deny that, to walk away from that, is to deny our Lord, because it's where he went. He came to the cellar, and he turned the light on. And when he did that, some people came to him, and some people ran. Mm-hmm. And we're doing the same thing now. And so I would hope that being at the conference and learning more and things like that will help people not run from the issues of trauma and deception and things, but more importantly, not run from him.
Well, amen. And a special thanks to Dr. Bob Tice and his wife, Lori, who are organizing that event for the Northgate Church at River Rock Northgate, 60 Hurdle Avenue. It's where it's all happening, Saturday, April 2nd, 8:30 to 4. And again, click on the link at WDCX Radio on Facebook or go to eventbrite.com, type in Buffalo and trauma, and it will bring you up to a place where you can order the tickets to go. Both links will get you to the same place, but you're going to need a ticket to come. It's free. And we'd love to see as many of you there as are being spoken to by the Holy Spirit today. Like, if you think that God's prompting you to come and be a part of ministering to people who are hurting, helping to bring things to the light so that God can do his work, then we would invite you to come and be a part of it with us. God bless you. And Diane, thank you so much for taking so much time to be here. We're looking forward to talking with Dr. Phil Monroe and meeting both of you in person on Saturday, April 2nd.
Thank you. Again, it's a privilege to be here, and I look forward to meeting you face to face.